This is your student radio station.
This is Raw 12:51 AM.
It may be reading week, but the news does not stop. On Raw 12:51 AM, it's time for Insights. Thank you for joining us. It has just gone midday on your student radio station, and we're here to bring you the latest news and discussion. I'm James Lewis in the hot seat for the next hour as we navigate the King's Speech. Yesterday, the government set out its plan for the next year in Parliament. The 21 pieces of legislation covered a variety of topics, from oil production to those pedicabs that you see in London tourist spots, and from crime to international trade. Now, I will have my expert guests in the studio here to delve into the details of what was in the speech and the issues that were left out. I'll also be asking about one law that they would introduce if they had the power to do so. And you can get involved too. Send us a message through the website or get in touch with us on social media. At Raw News Warwick on Twitter or X. Or you can even send us a voice message through Instagram, Raw1251News. And we'll also be going across the pond to see what's happening in America. With only 1 year to go until the presidential election, what's a Republican frontrunner getting up to? Testifying in a civil fraud trial. Mr. Trump won't be at tonight's Republican Party debate. So, what can we expect? And what can we expect over the next year of campaigning? Now, I can never do Insights on my own. I am joined in the studio by Ben. Ben, how are you doing?
Hello, good, thank you. Yeah, excited to get to talking about all sorts of stuff because there's been lots happening this week, hasn't there?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, different things.
A huge amount, I think, to get into with the King's Speech and some of the issues that have come up around it as well. But let's start Insight this week with a song, a warm from our playlist this week. I think this will make Izzy, host of Musicology, very happy. It's a bit of Jungkook. Standing next to you, and it's here on Raw.
Your student radio station welcomes you.
And welcome to Insight, your departmental show here for news on Raw 12:51 AM. And before we jump into the national news here on Insight, got a little update about what is happening on campus. There'll be no strike action at universities for the foreseeable future after the reballoting of the university and college union members failed to reach the turnout needed. The result of the ballot saw just over two-thirds endorse strike action, but only 43% of members voted, less than the 50% threshold needed by law. General Secretary of UCU Joe Grady said, "The national ballot results show university staff support taking action over paying conditions. However, anti-democratic restrictions, which single out trade unions for special treatment, mean no action can take place." Chair of the University and College's Employers Association, Raj Jethwa, has said for the sake of students and staff alike, it is now vital to work together to end the sector's recent cycle of industrial disputes. On the dedicated website for industrial action updates, Warwick has reiterated that the university is working towards missing marks being returned to students by this Christmas. So that is a short update about the strike action, which I know as students is something that is going to be would impact a lot of us here on campus. Now let's go into the King's Speech. Yesterday the government set out its agenda in Parliament in what is known as the King's Speech. Here's a little bit more about what happened.
The state opening of Parliament is an occasion full of tradition and pageantry.
My lords, pray be seated.
It marks the start of the parliamentary year, where the government sets out their aims and the laws they want to propose. Yesterday, King Charles delivered what is known as the King's Speech for the first time as monarch. This is an address written by the government and usually lasts for around 10 minutes. But before that, a piece of symbolism.
Close the door! The
door to the House of Commons chamber is closed on an official who calls the MPs to come to the Lords and hear the King, and this marks its independence. The King opened the speech with a remark about his late mother, the Queen, and then proceeded to outline the government's agenda. Through the speech, the Conservatives attempted to draw dividing lines with the opposition on two fronts. The first on energy.
Legislation will be introduced to strengthen the United Kingdom's energy security and reduce reliance on volatile international energy markets and hostile foreign regimes. This bill will support the future licensing of new oil and gas fields, helping the country to transition to net zero by 2050 without adding undue burdens on households.
And the second area was no surprise: crime and illegal migration.
My government will act to keep communities safe from crime, antisocial behaviour, terrorism and illegal migration. A bill will be brought forward to ensure tougher sentences for the most serious offenders and increase the confidence of victims.
Prime Minister Rishi Sunak set out the government's credibilities after a year of his leadership, going on to address his priorities outlined in the King's Speech.
Now that we strengthen the foundations, this King's Speech turns to the future, taking long-term decisions with a single objective: to change our country for the better. Change in our economy, with new legislation to improve our energy security. Join a huge trade pact with the fastest growing region in the world and prepare to seize the opportunities of a new technological age. Change in our society, with new protections for leaseholders and renters, a bill to safeguard the future of football clubs and fans, and the historic legislation that will finally create the first smoke-free generation. And change to keep our nation secure and our communities safe.
Change was the buzzword, with Labour arguing that the current government couldn't bring change about because the Conservatives have been in power since 2010. Here's Sir Keir Starmer.
What we have before us is a plan for more of the same. More sticking plasters, more division, more party first, country second gimmicks, and no repudiation of the utterly discredited idea that economic growth is something the few hand down to the many. In fact, today we reach something of a new low, because they're not even pretending to govern anymore. They've given up on any sense of service.
But there were issues where the Conservatives and opposition parties were in broad agreement, such as the smoke-free generation, where children who are currently aged 14 or younger will never be sold cigarettes. The speech, its contents and what was missing will continue to be debated in Parliament for the next few days.
And that was a quick explainer of what happened yesterday in Parliament with the King's Speech. Now, let's get into it, talking about some of the different policies that were announced by the government, maybe some of the stuff that didn't come up that we're expecting or would have wanted to have seen. Ben, what have you thought about this King's Speech? Firstly, did you watch it at all?
I actually didn't. I'm one of the people who looks at BBC News after the fact and reads through all that sort of stuff. But I think generally, a lot of the policies I did find myself agreeing with somewhat. I think there are a few that I'm a bit more cautious on. But I think the policies that were announced were generally somewhat decent changes. But I think one of the things that did concern me about it was that it was one of the shortest King's Speeches in sort of recent memory. Not necessarily in terms of length, but in terms of the number of policies that were announced. And I think for a government that's promising like wide scale, widespread change, you know, across the board, really, and Rishi Sunak promising like a change from the sort of Boris Johnson, Liz Truss era, I feel like he's not really living up to it in that sense. And I feel like that's going to end up affecting his chances at the next election.
It is one of those things, the length of the speech. I'm just trying to see if I can find the statistics on it. I'm trying to see if I can credit the person who I saw this on Twitter. But there was a journalist that tweeted that it... comparing, it was one of the longest in terms of length, as you said, but not having the content or the number of bills that previous King's Speeches or Queen's Speeches, as they would have been in the past, have had, which is something that it's definitely been brought up. I suppose looking in the next year, we're coming towards a general election. And these are the policies that could well go on to define the differences between the Conservatives and Labour and some of the other opposition parties at the general election. So let's get into some of those. I think one of the ones that was mentioned early on in the speech was about oil and gas and energy independence that the UK would have, the government would say, if they were to license new oil and gas fields, as the King's Speech has set out. The official name for the bill that will be brought about is the Offshore Petroleum Licensing Bill, which will allow for new applications in the North Sea to take place annually. And the government say that they will protect UK domestic oil and gas supplies, making the UK less dependent on imports into the UK of oil and gas. With the aim of the UK being able to reach its net zero targets. What did you make of that?
I think oil and gas is obviously a very pressing issue at the minute, because obviously we've got the prices rising with the cost of living crisis and that sort of stuff. And so I think that would definitely work to offset some of those price hikes. And then obviously all the stuff that cropped up last year with the Ukraine war, and obviously prices being increased even further through that, because we were dependent on Russia for a lot of different fuel and oil exports. But I think, I think it's a step in the right direction. Definitely. I'm personally of the opinion that all of the sort of net zero stuff is too little too late, in a sense. It needs to be done faster and a lot quicker in order to achieve the desired outcome. But I think that I don't really see any sort of negative, in a sense, with this policy, because I think it just allows the UK to be more energy sufficient and efficient as well. Ensuring that we as a country don't have to rely too much on different exports that are in itself volatile. I think it works on the whole.
I mean, this is a particular policy area talked about by obviously Labour, but particularly the Green Party have been strongly advocating against this policy that was brought in yesterday. Particularly Caroline Lucas, that their MP in Parliament, challenging Rishi Sunak on this. Now, the government did say in the King's Speech that they were going to continue to look at renewable energy sources. But do you think they're doing enough of that?
I don't think that they're doing anywhere near enough in terms of green energy. And I think that's going to be an issue that is prevalent for years to come, because obviously we've had Sunak sort of backtracking a bit on all the promised green targets, with I believe he ended the 2030 ban on petrol and diesel cars. That obviously was a backtrack, and I think that, you know, we will see a few more of those. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a few more of those, with sort of this being one of them. And I think while I can kind of understand the perspective of this one, in a sense, given the sort of current international climate of Russia having been sort of unable to supply a lot of the resources that we need, I think that in general, net zero is very much in trouble with all this sort of stuff that's being announced.
Yeah, as you said, we saw in September Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, pushing back the ban on the sale of new petrol and diesel cars until 2035. So it is definitely the licensing of oil and gas exploration is certainly one of the issues that has been more contentious in political debates following the King's Speech. Another area where the government, I mean, you could call it a wedge issue, where it's trying to build a gap between where the Conservatives and Labour and the opposition party sit, is on crime and migration. There are a few different bills that are going to be laid before Parliament that will speak to this. So one of them is a sentencing bill, which will introduce tougher sentences for people convicted of the most serious offences. So the main example used is murder with sexual or sadistic conduct, where criminals will receive a whole life order except in exceptional circumstances. But also in this bill is something that we discussed on Insight a few weeks ago, actually, with criminal justice reform, in the presumption of judges wanting to give a suspended sentence rather than prison sentences of a year or less. Are you surprised that this has come up in the King's speech from the Conservatives.
I think it isn't a very typical policy of sort of what you would consider the Conservatives to be as a party. But I do think that just in general, I mean, I said the same thing when we discussed it a few weeks back, it is a blanket problem to a systemic issue. And I think, you know, you just need to sort of look directly at the issue of prison reform and rehabilitation and all that sort, all the sort of things surrounding that. Whereas in this case, they're just trying to sort of offset some of the problems for as long as they can, and it just won't work. It'll just come and bite them back in the face. Yeah, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other bills, the criminal justice bill that is going to be brought to this parliament is features particular policies that have been talked about quite a lot, I think, in the media quite recently, with various different cases where defendants haven't attended their sentencing hearing. Particularly in, there have been lots of high profile cases.
Was it the Lucy Letby case as well?
Yeah. And the murder of Olivia Pratt-Corbell as well was another one where this was the case. So this bill will compel defendants to attend their sentencing hearing. And I believe that judges and those in the system will be able to use reasonable force to be able to make that happen. What do you think of this? Do you think this is a positive step forward for victims and for the families of victims?
I think that in a sense is a step forward, because I think that, you know, there's loads of different issues surrounding the sort of will they, won't they, of attending a sort of sentence hearing and that sort of stuff. You know, they have the right to sort of refuse that and just accept whatever the outcome is, or is it the right of the sort of family or of whoever's related to the issue? Is it their right to watch the person be sentenced and that sort of stuff? And I think I think it's fair enough to request or by reasonable force for them to attend their sentencing hearings, because I think there's the whole issue of, like, you know, what if they're not guilty, you know, what's that, what are the moral implications there? But I think, you know, obviously operating under the assumption by law that everyone's innocent until proven guilty, as long as they have been proven guilty, as is justified in the court of law, then I think that it's fair enough that they should attend their sentencing, because I think that it's part of that sort of system of respect, in a sense. You know, you have the same respect for the justice and law system as it has for you. You sort of take what you give, in a sense. So I feel like I can understand why some people might be against it, but I think that it would, in practice, it's perfectly fine.
Do you think it will work in when it gets to this point, that if defendants don't want to come to court for their sentencing, do you think it will work?
I mean, in some sense, if there's a use of reasonable force, they won't have a choice, in a way. But I don't know, really, because I think it sort of depends on the situation. Because obviously with the sort of Lucy Letby case and stuff, they were very, very high profile cases. You know, even though there wasn't, like, media allowed into the trial, as is standard in any case, there was still massive media coverage on whatever came out at the end of the day, you know, be that just through witness statements or even just court drawings. And I think that in cases like that, there's obviously that sort of conflict of interest there, where, you know, whatever the result is, somebody's going to be unhappy at the end of it. And I think that that's the same with lots of different cases. But I think, obviously, with reasonable force, it would create the desired result. As to whether that's a good thing is more up in the air, and I think that's down to sort of personal opinion, in a sense.
And there is one more bill, I think, that fits into this section quite well, is the Victims and Prisoners Bill. So the Huffington Post described this as a bill that will introduce reforms to improve the support provided to victims in the events of disasters or major incidents, while also reforming the parole system to rebuild public confidence. I suppose this is just another one of these bills in kind of the similar vein to what the Conservatives have been talking about. Do you think that the Conservative Party have got credibility in this area, that their time in government has proved that they are the party of law and order, as they often have been seen as?
I mean, party of law and order, all I need to do is mention the word Partygate, and then we spiral into a whole assortment of things there. To be honest, I personally don't think that any party really has credibility in this area, because I think it's just such an overlooked thing in general. Because obviously you have, like, you know, why should we care about criminals if they don't care about us? There's that sort of attitude that's so widespread throughout every party, and I think throughout the British public mostly as well. You know, it's the sort of, why should we care about them? And I think that is such, like, that's a view that is so, like, one-sided in a sense, because I think there is so much potential that can be had here, you know, to reform, to rehabilitate. And I think while some of these bills are a step, just in general, all the ones that we've talked about, they are a step in the right direction, they're not enough of a step in the right direction to make them have any sort of reasonable impact in the long term, I think. Like I said, it's sort of short-term blanket measures, whereas there is an entire sort of systematic wide problem that needs to be addressed, and it's just not getting done with these sort of small bills.
Do you think that's possible with, I mean, we always talk on this show about when the next general election could be. Do you think these sort of long-term changes are possible for any government of any sort of political affiliation to be able to implement these sort of longer-term reforms if they've only got maybe a year left in office?
I think it's difficult to estimate that. Because I think by sort of general estimations, this is the final King's Speech that we'll have of the Sunak government before the general election. At least that's what estimates generally say anyway. But I think, you know, there's so many different sort of long form changes that have happened throughout history that have gone between governments. Obviously, John Major started the work on the Good Friday Agreement that was picked up by Tony Blair, and then that became the Good Friday Agreement just a year into his tenure, really. And there's so many different instances. And I think we see too often at the minute, it's sort of becoming a lot more polarised. Like, I want to do this in my prime ministership so that I get the credit, and it's not a case of working together, it's a case of I want this, and then it just devolves into this whole thing where both Labour and the Tories try to one-up each other, and it just ends up backfiring on both of them, I think. So to be honest, I don't think that there is time for that sort of systemic reform if we assume that the Sunak government is going to most likely lose the general election, as is predicted, to Keir Starmer and Labour. But I think one of the things that I'd really like to see in the future is sort of addressing that issue directly, rather than just sort of making these small measures to sort of fix it temporarily when it just never works, and it hasn't in the past.
Well, we might have a look at some of the policy areas where there is some broad agreement that you have alluded to in a moment, but we'll have another song here on Insight, another one from our playlist this week. This is If You Need It by Sammy Virgil.
Listen to Raw if you want your seminar tutors to like you. This is your student radio station.
And it is Insight here on your student radio station, Raw 1251 AM. Thank you for joining us. We are discussing the King's Speech, the opening, the state opening of Parliament that happened yesterday, where the government laid out lots of different laws, legislation that they want to see passed in the upcoming parliamentary year. I suppose it's like the parliamentary new year. They all get together, the King comes in, the Lords get their robes on. If you see the pictures, they're all wearing red, the red and white robes. There's lots of fanfare and pageantry, as you would have heard in our little explainer package earlier on. Just a reminder that you can also let us know what you think about the King's Speech, and If you could introduce one policy in this year's King's Speech, what would it have been? Send us a message on the website or on social media, Raw News Warwick on Twitter or at Raw1251News on Instagram. Now, we discussed some of the areas where there was some more contention before we had a song. And we're now going to discuss some of the issues where there might be a little bit more broad agreement, more common ground, possibly, between the government and some of the opposition parties as well, and the devolved government. It's important that we remember with things like this that some of these policies will only apply to England or England and Wales, with Scotland, Northern Ireland and also Wales having their own devolved parliaments here. But one of these issues that has the support of the devolved parliaments is the Tobacco and Vapes Bill. Now, this is one of the issues, or one of the policies that came up at the Conservative Party conference a few weeks ago. Rishi Sunak wanting to create the first smoke-free generation. So anyone who's currently aged 14 or younger will never be legally allowed to buy cigarettes. And Ben, what do you think about this policy?
I have to say, I think I'm going to have a bit of a controversial opinion on this. I think that it's one of the best policies I've seen Sunak announce slash put through, hopefully put through, during his tenure. And I think it probably will be one of his biggest legacies, definitely. I really like it, to be honest. I can understand why people wouldn't, you know, find it appealing, because I think, you know, there's a whole sense of like freedom to, you know, choose to do what with your body, what you wish. You know, you can smoke if you want to, you can do whatever if you want to. But I think that just generally smoking is a very harmful thing. Same with vaping. You know, there's a whole thing around people saying like, oh, vaping's, you know, really safe, that sort of stuff. You know, that's what was said about smoking 30 years ago. And then look at the position that we're in now. And I think that it's better to be safe than sorry, in a sense. And I think that this bill is very much addressing that sort of mindset. And I just think, you know, smoking itself is harmful, not just to the smoker, but, you know, say if you live in a household with a smoker, then you will breathe some of that in and it will impact you. You know, I was walking the other day and there was a person who was smoking in front of me and they sort of blew the smoke out to the side and it went in my face and it was just not pleasant. But yeah, I think there's loads of different things that can be brought up around this, but I personally really like this idea. Yeah.
I mean, and those are the sentiments that have been echoed by ASH, the Action on Smoking and Health charity, talking about the welcoming this proposal in the King's Speech to introduce a smoke-free generation. Obviously, vaping is another aspect of this, and there's been lots of political discussion, and I think discussion kind of more generally about the availability of vapes to younger people, to children in particular, and the marketing of these vapes. See, there are we hear when this discussion comes up, vape manufacturers saying, or sort of the established companies saying that they always follow the laws, they don't have these flavors that sort of market to children. But obviously there is this potential market out there, that the online world, that is a little bit more of a gray area and a little bit harder to control. What do you think about that?
I mean, everybody has the sort of right to, you know, again, choose to do what with their body what they wish, and I think that applies to vaping. But I just think, why, in a sense? I don't understand vaping, just personally. And I think that there's loads of different issues that are associated with it. And I definitely don't agree with the fact that it's not marketed to children. You know, you have like bubblegum flavours and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it is inherently a childhood thing, really. I mean, I've never, you know, you see the occasional adult with a vape whenever you walk around sort of city square or a town or anything. But I mainly just see kids vaping, you know, people our age, people younger than us who are like still in sort of college, high school, all that sort of stuff. And I just don't, I really don't understand vaping as a thing generally. And I think measures to make it a safer hobby in a sense and turn it into less. And that basically means that there's less of a sort of addiction risk. I think that any measures to sort of address that are very welcome. Yeah.
Well, the vaping, some health professionals are seeing it as a potential way to quitting smoking,
yeah.
Which I think is something that this bill sort of will overall want to see in the long term, with banning the sale of cigarettes to those who are currently aged 14 and under. Another one of the bills has more broad cross-party support is called the Terrorism Protection and Premises Bill. It's also known as Martin's Law. It will improve the safety and security of public venues in the wake of the Manchester Arena terror attack that happened a few years ago. So obviously this is something that many parliamentarians, many people outside Parliament as well, want to see action taken upon, and it's been mentioned in this King's speech. So Ben, do you think this is something that all parties in government or all parties in Parliament are going to be working on together?
I think that, you know, any sign of sort of cross-party working together and stuff in such a polarised time, I think that's a really good sign. I don't actually know what the bill does in general. Is it just sort of addressing issues related to, like, terrorism,
yeah,
and
so,
security and that sort of,
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, so venues will have to prepare anti-terror plans.
Right.
That's part of what this is going to involve. So yeah, it will just be sort of these major venues being prepared. Obviously, having heard lots of the testimony that's come out of the Manchester Arena attack,
yeah,
and the inquiry that followed as well, sort of learning the lessons and seeing what can be put in place to safeguard against these sort of things, and what duties venues will have to improve public safety, and thinking about kind of the size of their venue, how many people are there, and what the venue's being,
yeah,
used for. So all of these things that will be coming into play, and something that I know many parliamentarians have also talked about as well. There's another one that I think is quite interesting that I just want to pick up on. It's about automated and these autonomous vehicles.
Mm.
These self-driving cars, effectively.
Yeah, I read something about self-driving buses before, like, 2030 or something, was it?
Yeah, yeah, and there will be protections in there as well to for businesses, for people using these vehicles, that they won't have to have somebody, or somebody won't be liable for what happens with these,
yeah,
like you have to have, at the moment, you'd have to have somebody else who's sort of there as a driver. I believe that the next stage of this is going to mean that that is not something that's particularly required.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult because I think, you know, you've got, like, the argument, you know, that there's less potential for human error and that sort of stuff. Obviously you have the other sort of side of it where it's like, this is someone's job, this is someone's livelihood, you know, what's the point of taking that away and replacing it with something automated when it's working perfectly fine as is? And I think a sort of fair balance between that is to sort of enact, you know, what you said, just about there being a sort of autonomous driving system and having that assist the driver rather than replacing them. I think that is the sort of go-between here that gets the best of both worlds. So I think it's going too far, in a sense, this bill. Because I think, you know, there will always be human error, but there'll always be robot error as well. You know, no program is ever perfect. No program ever runs eternally without mistakes. There's always going to be something that arises, and the presence of a human that allows for last minute adaptability, that sort of stuff. With a robot, they just keep going, they've no idea what they're doing, in a sense. They're just following whatever they're directed to do, and if that goes wrong, then there's nothing that anybody can do about it. So I think, yeah, this bill goes too far in the sense that I feel like it takes away from the livelihoods of like bus drivers and stuff that have been so crucial to society for, you know, years upon years upon years now as like the face of public transport in the UK. But I think it's sort of taking advantage of it in the wrong ways.
We'll have to see where this technology goes.
Definitely.
And the progression of it as well. Now, as we come to the close of looking at the King's Speech, been asking what line would you want to have inserted? What law would have wanted to have been made in the King's Speech? And I've got a few suggestions that have come through, some voice messages. So let's have a listen to those. This is the... I think these are both... have got probably not the sort of thing that you'd expect to see in a King's Speech, but I think they've both got passion or definitely an interest behind them. So this first one is from Ed.
Reducing the price of a chocolate bar, like the classic standard chocolate bar, to £1 from £1.25, because the fact that it's gone up has destroyed all the remaining hope I have left for this country.
And we have one more as well. This one is from Henry.
The King announces the immediate dissolution of Parliament and the return of absolute monarchy.
I have to say, I'm not 100% sure that we would have seen that during the King's Speech this year, or in any King's Speech, to be honest. But there we go. Ben, I believe you've got a suggestion as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just surprised that they weren't main policies, definitely. You know, the Freddo, it's been going up pence by pence every day, and it is unjustified and disgraceful. Yeah, very much agree with those. yes, I actually do have my own. It's definitely a controversial one. So my sort of first policy is votes at 16. I think that is very much something that I'm in favour of. I think that, you know, one of the main issues that we have at the minute is that young people are underrepresented in Parliament, and it's sort of run a lot by the sort of people who've been there from the 1960s, the 1990s, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I feel like we need to get more of that youth voice in Parliament. But I think one of the main issues or critiques that comes around with sort of votes for 16, whenever that's mentioned, it's always like, well, 16-year-olds don't have that sort of autonomous thought in the same way that 18-year-olds do. You know, they're still influenced by their parents, all that sort of stuff. So I would then argue, as a second policy, enact politics in the GCSE curriculum. And I feel like that would solve a lot of those issues surrounding being uneducated on politics, you know, just having like a sort of lesson in school where, you know, there's no like one-sidedness or anything. You just learn about the policies of one party, you learn about the policies of another, and then you get to be told how to make your own educated decision. I think that that's really valuable. And I think, obviously, we have a sort of participation crisis in the UK. I feel like that would go a long way into solving that, just in the sort of long term. Yeah.
Said like a true politics student.
Oh, how do you know?
Very good. All right. So that has been our discussion about the King's Speech and what we would have liked to have seen in the detail.
Freddo's. Definitely Freddo's.
Indeed. Well, let's have another song here on Raw. Afterwards, we're going to be crossing the pond, heading over to America to have a look at the situation in American politics at the moment. But before that, this is Big Sleep with Finger Licking Goodness.
Proving student radio can be good sometimes. Raw 12:51 a.m.
Thank you.
A little bit of Star Spangled Banner there for you as we cross to the United States of America.
Oh, joy.
I am going into the domain of Will Kingswood with Americanage, which is on Thursday from 2 to 3pm, which is always a very, very good listen to hear more and to learn more about American politics as well. Even if you don't know a lot about what is happening in the States, it's always well worth a listen. Because it is a year to go, just under a year to go, until the next presidential election in the United States. And American politics is never dull, is never quiet, is it? It really, really is not. And
it's not. It is unique. I feel like that is the best word to describe America currently. Unique.
I think that is probably a very good word to describe it. There were actually some elections, some votes that have taken place this week in the US, and what is being described as is quite a significant moment, or quite a significant set of results in American politics as well. Votes taking place in lots of states that could lean red, could lean Republican.
Yeah.
States like Ohio, Virginia, and Kentucky, with Democrats being able to prevail, and issues that Democrats have put on, I suppose, a little bit like a referenda in the UK.
Yeah.
They have these different votes, or these sort of issue votes, where one of them being abortion, obviously in the context of the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the United States. This is going to be an issue that is going to be, I think, at the heart of lots of political debate as we go into a presidential election year. But also the other victories for different Democratic candidates, as opposed to Republican candidates, who in some of these different states as well. Ben, what do you think about the state of American politics at the moment? It's a rather large question.
It's certainly in an interesting position. I think, obviously, a lot of these votes, because obviously we had last year, Rovember, with the sort of midterms that happened, and that led to sort of a big swing for the Democrats in some areas, and then a somewhat of a swing to Republicans in others, which is normal during midterm elections. But I think here, you know, we've sort of seen that abortion is very much a Democrat winning issue, because I believe in pretty much all the elections that the Democrats stood in, they won in terms of House majorities, Senate majorities, you know, all the sort of issue votes turned out in favour of providing abortion. Obviously, with Roe v. Wade being overturned, what was it, last year? Or was it even earlier than that? It feels like so long ago now. But I think it sets a really interesting precedent for the general elections next year, because I feel like it's fairly obvious that it will be Trump v. Biden 2.0, at least based on the polls at the minute. And it is going to be... I believe polls are saying it's pretty much a dead heat at the minute, which is slightly alarming. one of these things is not like the other. But I think that abortion is going to very much favour Democrats. You know, I think they've got loads of different things working against them at the minute. Obviously, there's the issues relating to Gaza and, you know, all that sort of stuff that's happening at the minute that have obviously caused lots of different controversies. And then there's also the issue of Afghanistan that Trump's no doubt going to bring up against Biden, and then Biden will just retaliate with stuff like COVID and that sort of stuff. But I think that abortion is going to be an issue that will see the Democrats heavily favoured. And I feel like it might win them the election, at least based off of, you know, the swings that we've seen here. Because Virginia traditionally is quite a Republican state. And, you know, now they've got a Democrat House, a Democrat Senate, all because of abortion, all because Democrats have used, you know, pro-abortion, you know, views to energize their voting base and get them out to vote. Whereas Republicans just aren't feeling the same way about Trump, it seems.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that turns out in 2024.
Well, you have just mentioned him, former President Trump. Usually at this point, you would have thought candidates for the nominee to be the party's representative on the ballot paper would be out campaigning, thinking about fundraising. Well, Donald Trump this week has spent some... he spent some time in a New York civil court, a civil fraud trial, which he denies the allegations about deceiving banks about his wealth. And he is also not going to be on the debate stage this evening. Well, this evening, American time, there is going to be the third Democratic debate. Mr. Trump will not be there. He'll be holding his own rally around half an hour away from where the main debate is going to be taking place. There are going to be five candidates who are going to be on that debate stage. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Vivek Ramaswamy, who is a businessman, Nikki Haley, who is the former governor of South Carolina, and I believe also she had a role in the UN. As well,
I think Nikki
was it Nikki Haley that had a role in the UN, or if I completely got that wrong? South Carolina Senator Tim Scott and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie are going to be on the debate stage. Yes, Nikki Haley was the ambassador to the United Nations from January 2017 to December 2018.
That's interesting.
I'm glad I remember that correctly. So those are going to be the candidates that are on the debate stage. Former Vice President Mike Pence.
He dropped out.
Yeah, he has dropped out of the race. What are you thinking about in the minute or two that we have left about this debate, about the chances that Republicans have?
I mean, personally, I think, you know, if Republicans want any shot at winning in 2024, they will nominate someone like Nikki Haley. I think Donald Trump, while obviously he energizes the Republican base, he energizes the Democrats base furthermore. Because I think a lot of the reason why we saw the turnout we did in 2020 wasn't because of votes for Biden. It was because a vote for Biden was a vote against Trump. And I think that if, you know, the same happens in 2024, history will just repeat itself, and we will see a massive turnout on the Democrat side just to try and stick it to Trump, in a sense. Whereas I think someone like Nikki Haley, while obviously she still has, you know, somewhat similar, very sort of Republican conservative views, she doesn't have that sort of, you know, political baggage with her, in a sense, at least in the same way that Trump does with all of his, you know, civil fraud trials, that's just damaging his credibility more and more, even though, you know, statistics suggest that his, you know, base doesn't really seem to care about that too much, at least at the minute. But yeah, I think there's loads of different things that will happen over the next year that will be very interesting to watch in American politics.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. And you can keep up with all of this on Americanage, Thursday, 2 to 3pm. Well, as we're coming right up to 1pm here on Insight, all I've got time left to say is thank you very much, Ben, for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for listening. We will be back next week.
Across campus, online, and on 1251 AM. This is your student radio station.